Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of Troy Noons is an Absolute Podcast. I'm your host, as always, John Casillo, and with me today is Dan Lyons.
Hello, everyone.
Happy the Mets didn't lose because Matt Harvey didn't pitch.
Yeah, the Mets are very good in non-Harvey days.
Yeah, it's
Harvey Day is no longer a holiday. It's not a good day.
It's like the Kershaw corollary. When Kershaw pitches, you expect to win. When Harvey pitches, you now expect to lose. But you expect to win the other four starts, so it's okay.
Yep. There are happier things afoot in the sports world than the Matt Harvey issues. And yet the Mets are only half a game back, so.
Exactly.
Cheers.
Yeah, taking 2-3 from Washington is definitely a plus.
Steven Matz is a wonderful person, aside from that first start where he gave up like a million runs in an inning.
Yeah, that's fine. we'll spare everybody the Mets talk, but we will say that the Mets are actually in better shape than people might think. And if you can take 2-3 from your rival and from the first place team, again, you are looking well. It is very early. The things that happen in May usually get far too blown out in baseball. For their own good, and they result in narratives that last sometimes until August, at minimum. Do not believe them. I can cite thousands of examples, even in my mere 28 years of times when May narratives were shot in the face as early as like June 15th.
Yep, that'll happen in baseball when you have 162 games. I mean, it happens in every sport, but like, compared to even like the whip around narrative coverage of like this NBA finals or this NBA season, it's always fun.
Which I love. We might as well jump into that for a few seconds while we're here. As a noted Warriors hater, it's hard to be happier than how I've been for the entirety of this Western Conference Finals.
I mean, I take most of my joy out of being a resident of Waiters Island. We had a recession for a couple of years. We are now on the way back. We're like that little like island town in Canada that's been trying to get Americans to move there the last year. Like, Waiters Island doesn't even need to market itself right now. It's no. Hot property.
He's jacking up 30 footers in people's faces.
But he's only jacking up like 7 a game, so it's not even that bad. He made like 3. He plays good D. It's a good time to be a Waiters Islander.
I would agree. I would also commend well, I'll say two things. One, I vastly underestimated how good of a coach Billy Donovan was at Florida, because for some reason, despite his entire time being there, I threw out the fact that he turned Florida, of all teams, into a national title contender. Like, that never factored into my mind. It's like, oh, he's a good coach because of that, which is stupid on my part. Because now, I mean, yes, he has Waiters.
He has Waiters.
He has Waiters already. No. Yes, he has Westbrook and Durant. But the defensive scheme that he's drawn up to not just, like, stop the Warriors, but drown them on live television is stunning to watch. And the fact that Golden State has zero answer for it is even more stunning.
It's just interesting because it's like, I mean, it's not like the Thunder gave the Warriors, like, I mean, they had the one game where they blew it, but like, it wasn't like they were the kryptonite to the Warriors all year or even last year. It's like they just discovered, oh yeah, our team is just fundamentally bigger than theirs, so let's just go do that. And it's just pretty shocking to watch the Warriors just completely unable to rebound, literally and figuratively.
Well, they're also refusing to. If you look at most of the tape, it's just this is what I've been saying all year. Once the wacky, like, 35-foot threes don't fall, there's no one there to do anything for the Warriors down low. Like, if the shots aren't falling, the Warriors are screwed. And they rode the longest hot streak I've ever seen in NBA history. 82 games worth of a hot streak that resulted in 73 wins. The problem is you started watching toward the end of the Rockets series, the shots stopped falling as much. The Portland series, other than that Curry game, like, Curry came back and fixed things, but only to an extent. The rest of the team was already coming undone a bit. And, like, admittedly, and you can ask coworkers of mine, I came in after the Western Conference Finals were decided, and said Thunder in six.
Well, I don't know. I have a hard time calling it like a fad or you know, an 82 game hot streak is a bit much, I think. I think it's more likely that like we found a really bad matchup for them that just figured out that it's a bad matchup for them. And I think they are kind of hitting a cold streak at the exact wrong time. So I don't think it's fair to take anything away from the Warriors, what they've done all year. But it is pretty like incredible to see the Thunder, who have been kind of maligned all year, especially Donovan. Like, people were saying Donovan wasn't any better than Scotty Brooks and all this stuff. And you know, maybe it just takes someone a little time to adjust to coaching in the NBA after coaching in college for like 25 years. I think that's a fair thing to allow someone. And clearly he's showing, you know, that he was a very spirited hire, which people liked at the time, I thought. So, yeah, I'm not a Warriors hater by any means. I mean, if they were to come back and win three of the next, I said have to win, three more. Yeah. It wouldn't absolutely shock me just based on how good they've been all year, but I will also be very happy, to see, I think it would be really cool to see, Durant and Westbrook get their shot at redemption against presumably LeBron, who is right now feasting on the rafters. Now that it seems like they figured out what they need to do. So for the NBA, I think they're just hoping that the Raptors don't win this series somehow, because no one's going to watch any of those games if the Raptors are in the finals.
Yeah, you know what? I was joking with a friend about this. Like, you know, the last time David Stern was faced with a small market final, the last two times, he shut it down quick. So I'm very curious to see what happens this time around if he was faced with an Oklahoma City-Toronto. Toronto is not a small market by any means, but I feel like the amount they register on American NBA fans' mindset is minimal at best, despite Drake. But yeah, this is going to be a test of whether Silver is going to call in the fix the same way Stern did against Portland and Sacramento in the early 2000s.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't see that happening. I just don't think I don't think they're worried enough about it, because the Raptors are just, when the Cavs are playing their ball, like, the Raptors are just overmatched. So, and yeah, I do enjoy like the hearing the chirping from Raptors fans and other people about how they are, in fact, a big market. It's like, yeah, but in basketball, it doesn't just mean like your market is not only like where you play. It's, you know, what brand you are, and the Raptors are just, they're not a big brand, and that sucks for them. They're a good fan base and kind of a fun team, but there's no way the NBA would delight in, oh, now we're going to get so many people in Winnipeg and to watch our games.
Oh, yay. There's displaced Grizzlies fans.
Yeah, they're going to be, I don't think they're going to, that's going to make up for the lack of LeBron. Like, sorry, Raptors.
That's a good point. And I mean, you look at like the Warriors until recently, the Clippers until recently. I mean, these are big markets that have possessed teams that just haven't succeeded. And yeah, if you don't have that brand aspect of it. And I mean, even a team like Memphis, you know, smaller market, but a marketability of there's a unified, you know, the grit and grind mantra that's probably dead and gone now, after like almost a decade of it. That's the type of thing that you can get behind. And I mean, San Antonio's a smaller market, and they're a team that just gets by on the fact that they've been good now for about 20 plus straight years. So
and it took them a while. Like, yeah, people in the mid 2000s didn't want to see San Antonio in the finals.
No, yeah, absolutely not. And like the Spurs were great for years with George Gervin. They were great for years with David Robinson, but without Tim Duncan and without Popovich figuring it out. You know, in that strike-shortened season, and then they beat the Knicks in five in the 99 finals, which still haunts me to this day. That's the type of thing that it was a launching point, and it could have been a flash in the pan. It could have been similar to a lot of those late 70s finals. You know, the Supersonics won one, the Bullets won one, the Warriors won one earlier in the 70s. But instead, it became this lasting kind of legacy of what San Antonio's system could do. You know, I guess the Jazz too, to a point of like a smaller market that had figured out something marketable for a long period of time. I mean, the Jazz made like 25 straight playoff appearances, largely based on, you know, Stockton, Malone, and Jerry Sloan.
Right. And then you look at like on the other side of the spectrum, like the Lakers were awful and not fun to watch. and nothing about them is good, and yet they were on national television, what, like 30 times this year? So, yeah, there's a whole thing there. And sorry, again, Raptors, sorry. Like, you're just not. Like, the Raptors were probably on national television like 5 times this year. And there's, you know, it sucks. It's not fair, but there's a reason for that.
I appreciate you not going to the obvious Knicks carrot just sitting there in front of you on that example. Much appreciated.
Yeah, well, I mean, I can only say so much about the Knicks.
That's fair.
I will say I've kind of warmed on, as a non-Knicks fan, I've kind of warmed on the Hornets hiring. I don't think it's great, but at first
better
I thought
than
it was
expected.
Pretty bad. And now I'm like, you know, it might be okay. Because like, he did have some interesting offenses in Phoenix, maybe. And they had some weak, strange circumstances with the Morris twins. Like, it wasn't like, not everything that went wrong there, I don't think you can necessarily pinpoint to him. So maybe it works out in a second stop. Like, I think you could have made a hire that on paper looks about as good and ends up being kind of boring. And this one, I think, has probably a higher ceiling and a lower floor than some of the other ones that could have been made.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I completely, as a Knicks fan, I completely buy into that concept. Switching back to Syracuse basketball, Syracuse faces Wisconsin again in the ACC Big Ten Challenge. This time they're in Madison. Dan, are you disappointed? Did you really want to see Maryland or another team that might really help out the strength of schedule? I know this year our non-conference features big names, but not necessarily a lot of, you know, weight in terms of the black and white numbers. Or you just figure, okay, just figure it out, SU. If you can beat Wisconsin, it's a nice pelt to have, especially considering that team's probably going to be a top 25-ish squad.
Yeah, I mean, I think I would have liked to see a different team just as we just played them, and I feel like we played them obviously in the tournament not too far long ago, so it's not quite like Cal, but it's and they're also a lot better than Cal.
Getting to Cal levels.
But yeah, it's like you don't want to see, especially for a non-rival, you don't want to see the same team every year. Like the Cal thing was like legitimately annoying. I just didn't want to, like, there are a better, more interesting teams to play. So on that hand, it would have been cool to see like Maryland, obviously, because we thought we might, you know, get a rivalry with them going until they left the ACC, or maybe even like an Ohio State, a chance of a rematch, and also probably a more winnable game. As far as the strength schedule, I think Wisconsin will actually be pretty good. They just found out last night that Nigel Hayes is coming back, who is probably their best player. He had a really bad like NCAA tournament. What is happening with Nigel Hayes level bad NCAA tournament, not just like a cold streak. They have Vito Brown, who's kind of a breakout player. So they have some, they're an interesting team. They are probably going to be in the top like 4 or 5 of the Big Ten. So it should be a solid game in terms of resume. But you know, we just played them. So it's a little weird they would give us those guys 2 years in a row, at least, you know, give us a year break between them. But, there could have been worse opponents. They didn't saddle us with like, you know, they didn't do something stupid and give us Penn State or something, so could be worse.
Much appreciated, ESPN/ACC/Big Ten.
Oh my God, LeBron come on. What is, I don't know if you have the DM on, but.
I thought about it.
A stupid thing just happened. Like, the Raptors just forgot how to play defense for a minute, and LeBron got an easy dunk in between like 4 players.
Oh.
It's 62-31.
Oh, no.
you don't need to put this game on. I don't know why I asked. Like, it wasn't like a you should. It was, oh, and Kevin Love just hit a transition 3. It's 65-31.
So this is like that war on Canada that we never had, but thought about probably a couple times in the late 1700s, early 1800s.
This is the South Park movie version of Eastern Conference Finals games.
Oh, boy. I guess continuing our whirlwind around Syracuse sports before we get to the topic at hand, which, sorry if you're just tuning in, you'll be listening to a Sun Belt football preview for the second half of this podcast.
As opposed to the Sun Belt football preview that could have broken out at any moment.
Literally.
Over the course of the last 4 months. We actually planned it this time.
Any moment in time. Dan and I actually sat down and had a concerted conversation about whether or not we would do this, and we decided yes as part of our extensive 2016 football season preview. There's an editorial calendar and everything, I swear. There's actually a lot coming at your way.
We have long production meetings
that largely involve me just commenting myself. Everyone else kind of gets involved when they want to, but it's cool. We plenty coming your way that you'll actually care about. This is more for us. But if you want to listen, if you care about other teams, I know for Syracuse fans, it's a weird thing caring about teams not in Syracuse. But if you want to hear what else is going on and hear about teams that we should probably schedule just for our own sake instead of scheduling no one and waiting until Alabama is the only team left, then yeah, this is the podcast for you.
It's also May, and as a peek behind the calendar of people who have to create content about sports, in May you're going to hear about random stuff that you don't care about just because there's nothing else.
That's true. And once you get to, I mean, it's not as bad as July. Well, early July. Early July, all you hear about is baseball. And then, like, that's fine if you care about baseball. But if you don't, even if you do, to be honest, there's a lot of just like trash narratives that get tossed around. At least now there's still a couple things that like are actually happening and actually going on and have some weight to them. But we're getting to that point in time when there's literally nothing happening.
Yep. And especially like in a pure college football sense, these are the dark days.
Yeah. This is peak off season. But on the bright side, we are, well, today 99 days, when you listen to this podcast, 98 days away from Syracuse kickoff.
Start getting your advent style calendars in order.
Yep. Anyway, two more things. One, Isaiah McDuffie, the three-star linebacker from Buffalo, decided to decommit from Syracuse today. Well, last night / Tuesday night. That kind of expected, just because Babers seems fine with just slashing and burning the previous recruits, which he's replaced them with comparable guys. I don't really argue with that. The bad part is that he committed to BC the same day, which, not great. Doesn't mean anything because it's only May, and you know these letters are non-binding until February. But nonetheless, bummed to see him pick a rival. Dan, I'm sure you feel the same way I do. It's a bummer in the short term, and the long term probably doesn't matter much.
Yeah, it is what it is. Like, you know, if he ends up at BC, he'll be like a footnote when we play them every year. Oh, that guy used to be committed to SU. But in the end, I mean, these are high school players that none of us have seen play live. Like, it is what it is. You'd rather not lose them. But again, he was also an early Schaefer guy. And as we've seen, a lot of the time, and this isn't a Babers thing, this is like just how college football works, the guys from the previous administration commits are often just not necessarily told that they aren't really part of the plan, but they're kind of just like led to assume that based on inaction, I'll say. So that seems to be what happened here. Wasn't like, you know, if he really wanted him to Syracuse, I bet he would have been allowed to, or, you know, maybe would have been more dickish about it and pulled a scholarship at the last minute. But again, not a Syracuse unique way to approach it from our coaching staff. It's just unfortunately kind of how this works. So there are, you know, probably not the best way to handle things, but that's college football. I think you can say that about a lot of things that happen in college football.
I would certainly agree. It's our last thing about Syracuse sports, at least. Syracuse decided to announce the members of the AD search committee today. A little bit different than last time. We're seeing a lot more folks who are really in the weeds with Syracuse athletics and less, you know, businessy folks. Dan, do you feel like Severud is definitely the most important person on the six-person committee, or does Dino Babers really hold a lot more cards than we think he does based on the fact that him, despite not coaching it down for the Orange, you know, is already one of the chief decision-makers for this school?
I don't know how big a role Babers will have with respect to, like, everyone else on the committee. Obviously, it's Severud. It's his decision. He's, you know, doing the things he needs to do to make it, you know, look like an inclusive process. But it is, I think, a nice gesture, if anything else, to have Babers there, because he is really the big question of the Mark Coyle transition. He was sorry. Did I just hit cut off? Okay, yeah, my mom told me.
You just hit hold.
Did you hear all of what I was saying?
All good.
Was Babers
did
you hear all of what I was saying?
No.
Not a big thing, you know. I don't know if he'll have like a huge influence on the direct hire, you know, more than anyone else on this committee. But I think it's just a nice gesture to show, you know, despite the fact that the person who hired you left, we are committed to, you know, your vision for the program and giving you the support you need. So even if, you know, Coyle is gone, Babers is still the guy. They, you know, stand by him as the steward for the program going forward. And that's, you know, that's a big thing because obviously Coyle and Babers didn't have like a huge relationship before the two, you know, were matched up here. Coyle made the hire based on Babers being the best guy available that he could get. But it still always makes sense. And that was one of the big questions before I left. Like, what happened to Babers now? And as we said last week, hopefully they treat Babers like he was hired by whoever the new AD is because he deserves the same exact shot that he was under before. So I really like that inclusion. I like Brittany Sykes being on there just because having an athlete on there and a group of a pretty limited group of six, like, that's always good, especially with some of the issues that we have in college sports now. So pretty interesting group, and I'm excited to see what they do here in the next couple weeks.
Yeah, agreed. And you know what I think with Babers, and I know a couple commenters pointed this out too, like the fact that Babers is on there means a lot of faith in him. Also kind of ties the new AD to Babers in a lot of ways because Babers now, like as much as he was a Coyle decision, the new AD almost becomes a Babers decision, even if Severud's the guy and probably is the guy who calls the shots here. It's good to intrinsically tie those folks. I mean, Babers isn't young. It's not that he's old, but he's not necessarily young either. I'm not banking on him being here forever, but it's also not outside of the realm of possibility that he's here for a while. Just good to see that, you know, he's interested in being a long-term option here, and Severud understands the importance of keeping him a long-term option, keeping him and Syracuse football, just front and center in terms of this search. I think that That was a great emphasis when we hired Coyle, and it's something that Coyle was very good at. You know, even in his limited scope, being at Boise State, he seemed to understand the importance of football and its exposure. And I think that now, you know, Severud, that bleeds through to him too. That he just intrinsically understands that football needs to play a central role. And I mean, you can make some cases for a lot of other coaches who've been around longer, and obviously Babers is the newest coach on campus and hasn't coached it down yet, but nonetheless, his influence is felt pretty widely because of his position as the football coach over any other sport.
Yeah, and honestly, Babers' influence here is probably the most important. Boeheim is the guy. We all know that Boeheim is the most important coach on campus, but Boeheim is going to be Boeheim and run his program no matter who steps in, unless something crazy happens. And we assume that after him it'll be Hopkins. So like basketball and lacrosse, we assume, obviously there are people who wish this wasn't the case, are kind of like on their own islands and they handle their business and they win a lot. And that's that. Football is the primary, he needs to be the primary goal of the next AD. It was for Coyle. It was supposedly for Gross. He made one out of three good hires, and that, you know, it happens. But that needs to be the focus of whoever the next AD is getting football right. Obviously, that's been the last two as well. And that's why having Babers involved in this is pretty important, where, you know, lacrosse and basketball, obviously, Boeheim's going to talk to this person, and technically he's going to be Boeheim's boss. But odds are, unless there's another, like, NCAA thing, Jimmy B is the it's his program, and he'll check in and, you know, maybe give a, you know, an update here and there. But it's Boeheim's baby, where the AD is going to be way more responsible for what happens with the football program.
Completely agree, and it is definitely a weird scenario for any AD to walk into, I would assume. I mean, there's a limited amount of programs that fit this profile, and that goes to football or basketball. I think Jim Boeheim's Syracuse basketball program is one of them, where you walk in and as the AD, you don't really have much say, and that's kind of one of the conditions of hire. I would have said the same thing about, Pete Carroll's USC. At one point, you know, Paterno's Penn State. I'd say the same thing now about, you know, Coach K's Duke, Roy Williams, UNC. Like, there's programs that fit that profile. I don't think Bill Self's Kansas is there, but I think it's almost there. There's just certain programs you just know intrinsically that, like, this guy calls the shots. And obviously, you know, mostly Syracuse fans listening in on this would definitely agree that this is Boeheim's show, and especially now that he's in kind of the twilight of his SU coaching career, that him being involved in this process doesn't really make any sense. When he's going to work with that person conceivably for a very short period of time. And also makes sense from the standpoint that Syracuse football needs to be fixed and that Babers is your guy, at least until proven otherwise.
Also, like how many rounds of golf does this toss behind? That's important. Like, it would just, I don't imagine Jim wanting to do extracurricular stuff as much as he likes the school. Like Jim seems to want, you want to let him do what he wants to do. And this doesn't seem like a process. Like he never really seems to want to get involved in like higher up stuff. People always clamor for Jim to be the AD, but like, hey, I can never imagine him wanting that job. And he's like the least Barry Alvarez person in the world. Like Barry Alvarez at Wisconsin takes over the football program every couple of years just for a game, just to like satiate whatever ego he has. And Boeheim, like once he's gone, like he'll be around, but you're not going to see Jim Boeheim meddling in affairs. Like, once he's out. So that goes along the same lines as this AD search. Like, he's going to go with... I mean, he's actually also, like, as outspoken he is, he's a pretty good company man when it comes to stuff with SU. So I wouldn't expect a lot of, like, politics from his end. He's going to say he likes to hire. He's going to say the guy or woman's a good, you know, fit, and he's going to go with it.
Yeah, I would agree there, and that's why I've been pushing for a long time. Well, not really a long time, since the article appeared a couple of days ago. I would love for Syracuse to troll all of you people, and I refer to a good portion of you listening, even that want an SU guy as the AD. I would love, and I said this in the article, I would love for Doug Marrone to be the new AD, just because it would check all your boxes. Except you would always have that lingering fear that he had one foot out the door. And I think, to me, that's good enough. I would take the small victory of trolling with a larger victory of someone that actually understands how to fix Syracuse football in a hurry.
Oh, God. I can't decide if Dunmore would be the worst or best at that job. Like, it seems totally contrary to what he does. But at the same time, like, I it would be worth it for the hilarity of it. Because you know he would step in and do a really nice job for like 4 years and then leave to go take the job at like Ole Miss or something. And people would lose their minds.
Yeah, I mean, what I would love, to be honest, is if he left after 4 years to take the job at University of Buffalo. Because that would just... You're talking chief trolling. I mean, Doug Marrone is already teetering on the edge. I mean, the fact that he left the Bills to go be... You know, just a BS position coach in Jacksonville.
Well, he left the Bills to get paid and then thought he was going to get another head coaching job and didn't because Manish Mehta decided to carpet bomb his candidacy with the Jets.
Agreed, but now that we're living in the reality we are, Jacksonville's actually in a pretty good place in terms of roster and personnel. I think they actually did a great job of, I mean, they didn't rebuild on the fly. It took them like several years, but I think Jacksonville is easily one of your like kind of dark horse, going to be one of the favorited dark horse picks in the NFL this year, as far as playoff teams go. I just think that in the end, everything always comes up Doug Marrone. It doesn't really matter what he does and where; just everything works. And you're going to see it again this fall when Jacksonville goes 9-7. Like, Doug Marrone is once again going to be seen as, you know, this miracle worker.
They will not. I mean, A, I think you're at the Jets. I think they have a fun young team. They might be like a year away, but I think they will be pretty decent down the road. And B, Doug Marrone is going to get another head coaching job, probably in the NFL, maybe in college, even though it doesn't sound like that's something he wants to do, but just be ready, everyone.
Yeah, I could not see him coaching college again. Under any circumstances, it's just not his bag. He hates every process of it, which is why I pointed out in the post, like, if you're the AD, you don't have to deal with any of that crap that you hated. Like, you can just sit there, make your decisions, and let people bitch about it, and you don't really have to care, especially at a private school. Their money's not paying for you to be there.
Doug Marone would literally never do media. He would not, he would do the first press conference and then like, we wouldn't find out that Marone stepped down until like 4 months after it happened.
when you walked into the office and there was like moldy bologna and like Gatorade past its expiration date.
Just like pre-mid and midst like outer Gatorade, like
freezer burn Dove bars.
Oh god.
Let's all appreciate the fact that Doug Marone had like staple and go-to foods that you'd be able to cite as his.
I saw Doug Marone buying those foods multiple times after games when I was making beer runs at Tops.
Oh god.
Like more than once.
Oh Doug. Oh Doug, I miss you.
I wish I had taken note of what beer, like, because we were like beer shopping next to each other, and I wasn't smart enough at the time to like figure out what he bought. It was probably like Miller Lite.
It was almost definitely Miller Lite.
Like, Doug is definitely not a big highbrow beer person like us.
No.
He's just Bologna, Gatorade, Dove Bar. Like, Dove Bars. I, like, come on, Doug. Like, Dove Bar, it doesn't really even fit in.
I mean,
it's like way too fancy for him. I guess that's he treats himself. Like, he's going with the Bologna and the probably just yellow Gatorade. Like, he's not going to mess with some other, like, fancy flavors. Dove Bars, he'll, you know, he'll throw the extra couple bucks down, not get, like, the, like
store brand
or whatever he can find.
Yeah, I buy that about Doug. That was a good segue into beer. Dan, what have you been drinking of late?
I actually pulled my weight a little bit this week. Mostly last night, where I inadvertently ended up at a bar. I hadn't realized I had this before, but apparently I have. It's the Two Roads and Evil Twin collaboration, Geyser Gosa, which is quite good.
Oh yeah, I've had that. Really enjoy it.
Yeah, it's like super like bitter and sour, but like also really refreshing. So I had had that before, but when I ordered it, I had it. I had Westbrook's IPA, which was very solid. Probably not quite as good as some of the other things from Westbrook I've had, but like a really rock solid IPA, would definitely drink again. I had Grimm Artisanal Ales, Neon Lights Saison, which was really enjoyable. Really just nice and light, not like one of those super like heavy, overly sweet Saisons. It was really nice and drinkable. I also had from Grimm their Force Field, which was, I don't remember, it's, yeah, that was the IPA from them, which was really nice. Kind of had a really interesting hop profile, really clean, not like too like ridiculously overhopped, really easy on the palate, but some, and a little lower ABV. It was like almost like a borderline like session, so that was good. I had lunch from Main Beer Company, which I think we've talked about in here before. Main Beer, just like maybe one of the more underrated East Coast beer. Like, I
love lunch.
Lunch, really good. I had Edward from Hill Farmstead, also really good.
Jeez, where the hell did you go this weekend?
There was just there's this place like Midtown we stumbled upon. And then tonight I had a Matilda from Goose Island, which was delicious. Same place I had the Bourbon County, so they have a pretty good Goose Island selection. That's the Hoboken Bar and Grill in Hoboken, New Jersey. So that was fun. So really solid couple days here.
Interesting. Yeah, I've literally never heard of this place, and I really like the beer list. The fact they have several Hill Farmstead things on tap is all I need to know. That's good to note for next time. I will be in New York, which will be next March.
Yeah, all that was at District Tap House, which is in like 38th and 8th, I think. It was just a random place in Midtown I'd never heard of. One of my roommates was there, so I stopped by. I'd seen the beer list, and it was very, very good. So I made my way there.
Nice. Yeah, and I will. Once I lock down that date in New York, I will let you know, because as viewers probably figured by this time, Dan and I definitely make sure to drink together the few times we were in the same city.
Yes. Always a good time.
A couple from me. There's one great tapas place over by my house. It's called Mediterraneo. Has a very good beer list, but like nobody talks about it, which is great because then it's not crowded. Had a Blind Pig IPA from Russian River. You can only find Blind Pig down here on Draft Now. Last year, for some reason, Russian River stopped doing bottles in Southern California. I'm not sure why, but in any case, you can get it on draft at various locations, Mediterranean being one of them. Stopped over at Monkish Brewing Co. for a few beers. Had Stone Kisses. It was a tart saison with apricots. It was very, very good. I hope they bottle that one. So I had a Super Dupa Fly from Monkish. Monkish worked with Other Half over in Brooklyn to create one of the only kind of breweries that makes East Coast IPAs, which is awesome, just because it's a nice change of pace from what we're used to out here, the kind of super hoppy bombs that I'm typically drinking. Nice to drink one of those. Every so often had a Next Level IPA from Hop Saint Brewing. It's actually right over here, the Redondo / Torrance area. And they just opened recently. What else did I have? Had a Chupacabra Quinceañera. It's another saisonish thing, this time from the brewery. And then today, I've been enjoying had a Zombie Dust, which can't top Zombie Dust fresh. I had that like 2 weeks old. Three Floyds, fantastic pale ale. And then I also had a Todd the Axeman, an IPA from Surly. And Surly's some great stuff for those who get to enjoy it. They're from up in Minnesota. Have had a couple of theirs via trade, and also they show up at Stone's anniversary party annually. So yeah, had a couple of their stuff, but this was again very good.
Yeah, I feel like Three Floyds is like one of the big ones I could never find out here. So
they don't get outside of like the greater Chicago area for the most part. So they're like right outside of Chicago in Indiana, in Muncie. No, Munster. Sorry. You're not gonna get much in terms of Three Floyds outside of that area. Like if you go in Indianapolis, you'll get some six packs, but by and large, like Three Floyds is pretty localized. I'm a big fan of theirs. I stopped at the brewery when I was up in Chicago last year. I was driving down to Louisville and swung in for a quick flight and some lunch. Definitely enjoyable, but highly recommend for anyone. If you're in Chicago, it's well worth the quick 40-minute drive outside the city to get the Three Floyds.
Yes, one of the places. I've been to Chicago, but not for a long stay. Someday, hopefully. Can do it for that greater.
Do it. All right, now the purpose of this podcast, a little bit of Sunbelt action. Dan, what do you want to start with? Players, teams, what are we going with?
Teams is probably easier just because like know their profiles overall better than like the individual guys.
That's fair. All right. So, why don't we start with a little Appalachian State? Appalachian State, as most people know at this point, upset Michigan almost a decade ago. It was hilarious, even despite the fact that I wasn't really part of the college football internet at the time. I laughed quite a bit when the Mountaineers beat Michigan that year.
Michigan, which was ranked, I think, fifth in that.
Yes. The first team to ever fall from top five to unranked in 1 week.
Yeah, it wasn't like Brady Hoke losing App State, which A, would have absolutely happened.
Yes.
And B, like, you by the last year, Brady Hoke, like, yeah, okay, that makes sense. Like, this was a national title contender losing to Appalachian State at the time, an FCS team. A really good FCS team, but an FCS team nonetheless.
Yeah, I laughed.
Not even FCS. I think they were still D1AA then, but either way, yeah. Same thing.
FCS at the time, I don't even think they put in like a great season that year. Like they weren't. I don't think they even got to like the semifinals of the FCS playoffs that year. But hilarious to watch that, obviously. But since they showed up in FBS, Appalachian State's actually done pretty well. Really enjoy the product they put on the field. I think they have some nice classic jerseys that I can always appreciate. And I've I've got them based on my ridiculously early grid that Dan has seen before that I usually put together like around March. I've got them around 9-3. I think that they return a ton on both sides of the ball. They seem like a team that, while they might rack up a couple losses in non-conference, I think that the Sun Belt is very much a two-part league. There's the top half that is perfectly serviceable in most conferences, and they would do well in any group of five league. And then there's the bottom half that is god-awful. I think Appalachian State, you know, exists in that top half there. They look like a title contender for the league. I'm putting them in third, but at the same time, like, I could easily be swayed to first, and I figure most would probably feel similarly.
Yeah, I mean, Bill C has done with his Sun Belt stuff, which thank God, because that allows us to do this with a somewhat informed take. But yeah, he has like that upper tier pretty well defined between them, Georgia Southern, and Arkansas State. And like you said, like 9-3, I think is. I think it's going to be hard for them to really vary outside that range unless they have a disappointing season, because you have at Tennessee to open, which is like Tennessee could very easily like not live up to expectations.
Please, yes.
Which I almost kind of want to fade Tennessee this year pretty hard. I feel like it's getting kind of crazy with how much people talk about them, and I get it; they're super talented. But like they really like they came on strong last year, but like they haven't proven in top competition. That's a stuff for another time. I think like Washington is now approaching.
I was gonna say Tennessee's East Coast Washington.
Like I think Washington's a good coach. They have a lot of talent. Like, but man,
but
like,
you're not USC and UCLA.
No one was talking about them like 2 weeks ago, and all of a sudden, like, is Washington gonna win the Pac-12? Like, I mean,
no.
But why are we saying this now? Like, yeah. What happened?
The question is, why isn't Stanford or Oregon gonna win the Pac-12?
Right. I feel like this happens a lot in college football. Like, it's both the Heisman contenders, like the top couple, always like it feels like no one really goes wire to wire anymore. I guess Mariota was kind of close, but. It seems like there's a flame out more often than not, and someone comes out from like the middle or bottom or third tier of contenders, and then with like these really like trendy picks, I feel like they don't work out more often. Yeah, you know, more often than not, they don't quite reach the level. And Tennessee, I feel like we were talking about like last year, not quite the same level, but similar stuff.
Breakout and like yeah, they've gone through enough this offseason because of their own issues over there. I just think that there's just with Tennessee, with Washington, with any breakout team like this that you just get all over. I mean, at least Tennessee is like a 2 year history of it, so there's a chance that they break out this year. Washington, I think, is really like a mediocre team that this year just caught fire in people's eyes, and it's largely because of just the length of the college football offseason. Is that narratives have enough time to change despite the fact there's nothing going on? I think in other sports, the offseason is just never long enough for more than one narrative to catch on. Like here, you know, again, you're looking at a team like Washington that, you know, recruits top 40. Peterson's obviously a great coach. He did great at, you know, Boise State, but there's little to tell me that Washington is any better than a top 30-ish team at best, and then that's
and that'd be a nice step up for them.
Yeah, that'd be a great step up. Like, let's not rush to the end. Like, Washington should be very talented, but like local talent in the Pacific Northwest isn't great. Like, it's Oregon largely gets a lot of its kids from California. Like, let's not skip to the end where Washington is suddenly 10-2. Like, Washington, like, I'm not going to be disappointed when Washington probably goes 8-4. Like, that's fine because you're in the same conference as Stanford and Oregon, which at this point are, you know, 10 to 15 year established powers who are not going to suddenly, like, drop off to the point where Washington is going to be able to run roughshod over the Pac-12 North.
Right. So, anyway.
Back to the Sun Belt.
they probably aren't going to beat Tennessee at Tennessee after saying all of that. I think Tennessee.
We can pray that.
I think it'll be like kind of like that LSU Western Kentucky game last year, where it looks like kind of more competitive than it actually is. Tennessee, I will look to make a statement, and I think they'll probably end up beating App State by like 17.
Yeah, I'd buy that. I think, you know, you have, I mean, Taylor Lamb is one of the best, if not the best, QB in the entire Sun Belt. But I think in general, like, Appalachian State's the type of team that is going to hang around for long enough to worry you a little bit, but not long enough to beat you. Other people have pointed this out, but the one odd thing on this schedule, hosting Miami September 17th. Why?
I don't know. I think the full cast just did like a whole thing on this.
They did, actually.
They previewed Miami, and I think most of the preview was, wait, why are they going to Appalachian State? And I also asked the question, why are they going to Appalachian State?
Miami never got the memo that they were in the ACC.
You play in North Carolina.
They're still scheduling for the Big East, so they figure, okay. Yeah, we got to get on the road. We got to go on the road for this really in-demand recruiting hotbed.
And also, you know why it's really sad? Is because this is something Syracuse would do.
This is exactly something,
and something Syracuse might have to do soon.
Like, yeah, based on what we're... If viewers recall, we Dan and I were on the podcast one morning a couple of years ago when Syracuse announced that it was doing a two-for-one with Central Michigan. And we were losing our goddamn minds because why are you doing a two-for-one with Central Michigan? Especially when Central Michigan's one of the better MAC programs on a year-to-year basis. There's not enough. Now it makes sense because...
And that actually worked out. We won. I mean, I think we still have one more, right?
Yeah, we still have 2017. And I mean, at the same time, like, Central Michigan had a cheap shot on Dungy that could have altered and still might.
About that. So it kind of worked out, maybe.
Kind of, yeah. Still probably altered the course of his career for Syracuse. At the same time, it also helped set up a very strong Michigan pipeline that Syracuse has been building since Dino Babers showed up and Mike Hart and Vincent Reynolds. There's a lot of pieces that say that Syracuse is going to need to rely on Michigan talent, among others. But so good in some ways, bad in others. I wouldn't say it's a net loss or gain. I think it's just a break even, which is whatever.
Yeah, I mean, it could have been worse. Would rather go 2-for-1 and play like Eastern Michigan, but whatever.
Well, I'm not going 2-for-1 with Eastern Michigan. They're getting one off.
Or 3-for-1.
Screw those guys.
Yeah, call Rob Murphy. Let's figure this out.
Listen, Eastern Michigan.
I mean, if you're gonna pass over to Michigan, like, why not go get like the Jimmy game?
Yeah.
If there is one. Just like Central Michigan definitely wasn't. And I know we blew them out.
We would have blown them out last year if it wasn't for the fact that they tried to kill Dungy.
Anyway, I mean, those, like, basically those were two bowl teams that we played, and we kind of, like, it not necessarily, like, wasn't a sure thing that it would have played out the way it did. Also, I'm watching this Cavs game, and the Cavs logo kind of, like, the Big C logo kind of looks weirdly like the Central Michigan logo.
Yeah, I buy that.
Anyway, so yeah, App State post Miami next year, which is a thing. I assume Mark Richt will have that team ready to be App State, like, Miami.
Yeah, I buy that. Allen.
That game, I would not be surprised if it was like a touchdown game, though. Because, like, App State's quite good. And Georgia
had always, like, fucked up, like, one game a year where, like, they either completely screwed the pooch or they, like, sat there and almost lost a game that they should have won going away. Whether it was, like, to Vandy or, like, when South Carolina was bad, which they might be again. That was the type of thing that, like, Georgia used to do on a regular basis. So I feel like that's a perfect opportunity for the Mark Richt has lost control meme to come right on back when they probably almost definitely are within a touchdown of Appalachian State, like, early in the fourth quarter.
Oh, I look forward to it. And I like Mark Richt. I think he seems like a good guy. And like,
no, same. It's a great hire.
It's a great hire. It makes all the sense in the world. There's going to be some funny things that happen with him at Miami. It's too perfect for it not to, like, have some stupidness. Especially like that fan base and everything. So, definite moment of possible hilarity. I do think the Canes will win because, like, they have Brad Kaya and they have a lot of other talented players and a good coach. So, hopefully it all works out for them. I'm looking at the rest. Like, those are two pretty tough games. They have ODU. They have at Akron, which isn't
the gimme because Terry Bowden is a frightening individual.
He's bounding it up over. you get to travel to that. I mean, I've actually seen a game at Akron. I've made the trip. So.
Why?
Syracuse played there. It was the beginning of the 2010 season.
Oh, God. That was, yeah. That was my first year off campus.
We made a road trip.
No.
There are buildings right near the Athens Stadium. It actually reminds me of kind of like a nice, like, newish minor league baseball stadium. It's like, you know, it's definitely new. Like, you know, you're at a place that they just built. It's fairly decent. I haven't been to a lot of other, like, tiny cultural stadiums, though, so I don't have a huge frame of reference. The rest of this area around Akron, not the best. So yeah, that's a trip they'll make. That could be tricky. I think App State's going to be a decent amount better, but Akron's been a pretty solid middling MAC program, borderline bowl team for a couple of years now. So not the Akron that we lost to one time.
Oh God, that team. Well, that team was actually recruited in large part by Reno Ferry, who was our current tight ends coach.
Oh, God. It's a full circle.
Yeah, it is full circle. I remember I wrote the article about when he's hired. It's like, oh, God. Like, you remember that game that you absolutely hated? This guy was responsible for the guys on that team.
Yeah, that team finished 5-7, I just looked up. And I'm going to look up what they finished in S&P that year. Because I want to really understand how bad that Akron team lost to was.
I walked out in the fourth quarter and I was like, it can't get worse. Like, this is rock bottom.
Yeah, not great. That was my second Syracuse football game ever. First one being a just disaster to Penn State.
Yeah, I'll outdo you on the first Syracuse game ever, and that was, I was there for the Iowa game.
I mean, at least it was Iowa.
Yeah, but it was the double overtime Iowa loss where we got stuffed at the goal line 8 straight plays.
I don't know what's worse. Like, what's worse? Like, losing to Penn State 55-6, where on the second play of the game you force a fumble on the Carrier Dome, which is 48,000 people there. Like, it's as loud, to this day, still maybe the loudest moment I've ever experienced in the Dome. And then the player two after that, you fumble and hand Penn State a touchdown.
No. I still recommend the latter. The loudest I've ever heard the Carrier Dome was when we were down 24 to Wichita State my freshman year. We completely closed the gap, and then Demetrius Nichols missed a layup, well, it was a dunk, basically, in the final minute, and we lost the game by one.
None of these things are good.
No, none of these things are good at all. As I pointed out before, my experience in the first 2 years at SU largely shaped who I am as a fan, because I got to watch, you know, 5-6-ish wins is for football total in that time period. And I also watched 2 straight SU teams miss the NCAA tournament. Not a great run, but one that largely shapes my cynicism to date.
So this is your Bane origin story.
Exactly.
You were born.
Hello! I was born in the darkness. Hello, Jim Bane.
Oh, God, this has totally gone off the rails.
Very much so. My wife's looking at me going, what the fuck are you doing?
Oh, God.
Don't care.
Appalachian State.
Pretty good. They're pretty good. I already said 9 wins. Dan, what are you looking at based on the schedule?
I like 9. I don't know what to make of at Georgia Southern. It's tough. Obviously, that's like the swing game here.
Coaching change.
I'm going to go 10. I'm going to have them beat Georgia Southern.
Oh.
I just, Billy Fritz was a really good coach, and he ended up being perfect for that program. I'm not totally sold that they will just port in and stay where they were. And App State, they have so much returning talent, a really good quarterback. They have, like, 18 running backs that are all really good. I think they'll win a squeaker down in Georgia Southern. What city is that? Statesboro. Statesboro. I got it right.
Yeah.
So I'll take a 32-30 win or something along those lines.
Fair enough. We're not going to do all these teams because we're already like knocking on the door of an hour.
I was thinking that as soon as we started diving deep into Tennessee for no reason. I was like, we are not talking about all 10 of these teams.
Nope.
We can remind you of all the teams in the Sun Belt because there is a good chance 99% of our listeners
have no idea.
Will not know who's in this league.
And that's fine. The flux in this league has been tremendous. to once again channel Doug Marrone today. Arkansas State, I think that they are year to year the most talented team in the Sun Belt. I think that last year they were probably one of the 30 to 35 best teams in the country. I have Arkansas State based solely on returning talent on defense. They do lose a quarterback. That's problematic. But largely, I still think Arkansas State is good enough to win this league. I think that in general, like they, other than the at Auburn trip, I'm not really worried about any of these non-conference games. I mean, maybe you want to make a case for Utah State. You can. But I think a lot of their road games are... They've had three straight road games in the year, which I don't love, but they're all against winnable opponents. It's Troy, Lafayette, Texas State. Like, none of these games really scare me. I think in general, you're looking at an Arkansas State team that that's very good. They avoid Appalachian State. And do they avoid Georgia Southern? Nope, they don't avoid Georgia Southern, but they get Georgia Southern at home. They get South Alabama at home. This looks like a team that, even if they're not the best team in the Sun Belt, they have the most advantageous schedule. If I had to, basically just on that.
Yeah, I like Arkansas State to win the league again. I'm kind of assuming that they'll get good quarterback play. I know they just had Justice Hansen is now eligible to play. He transferred from
somewhere.
Bid program. Alabama. No.
Oh, perfect.
Oklahoma.
Even better.
D-liner came from Alabama. Basically, Arkansas State's whole thing is like they recruit pretty well for the Sun Belt, and then they go get all the transfers that end up going down a league from like the SEC.
That's fine.
Yeah, so that's like their whole thing. They have D-liner, the famous one-time five-star defensive line recruit who is the most perfectly named person in college football. They have like, I think they have a TCU guy who can play now too. So basically, they just like, basically how transfers work in the SEC is either someone goes JUCO for a year and then transfers to Auburn, or they transfer to Louisville, or they transfer to Arkansas State. It's like one of those three, like 90% of the time. So they have a lot of talent. They just bring back a ton of guys. They're super like athletic across the board, and they kind of like snuck out of nowhere to win this league last year. People thought it was going to be App State or Georgia Southern, and they just kind of got hot at the right time and stole it out at the end of the year. And I think they're going to be even better this year. I think they just improve and they bring back so much. So I like them to take this lead this year. They do have some interesting games. They go to Auburn, which I'm going to assume Auburn won't have a similar performance like they had against was it Jacksonville State last year, where they
that sounds right.
I think they should have lost.
Yes,
if Jacksonville State didn't have like some of the worst like game time management of all time, and tried to actually win the game. They play Toledo, which is tricky. They play Utah State, which is tricky. So, like, the non-conference isn't all that friendly, but in conference, like you said, they avoid App State. They bring Georgia Southern to Jonesboro. Is that the set? Did I get it right?
Yes.
Oh, I'm killing it. A lot of boroughs in the Sun Belt.
Killing it.
Yeah, so... They are my pick to win the Sun Belt based on my small amount of knowledge about the league.
Samesies. Georgia Southern would be next on my list. Dan, I'm going to run out for literally 30 seconds. So why don't you start with Georgia Southern, and I will jump right back in.
Okay, I'm vamping about Georgia Southern. The Eagles, they do triple option. They are basically the more fun and lower conference version of Georgia Tech. They apparently almost mutinied as a program when Brian Van Dorder was head coach and wanted to not run the triple option, and he got run out of town. So it's like a big thing to them. It's like a strangely, they're like very strangely dedicated to their system. They've been really good. They were an FCS dynasty. They beat Florida a couple years ago when the two Florida players blocked each other, so that was fun. So yeah, this is kind of a rundown of where you know them from. They, like the other two teams, all three of these top teams bring back a ton of talent. The big question for them is they had a coaching turnover. Willie Fritz somewhat surprisingly left to Tulane, which is probably a little bit more of an high upside job, but, you know, the jury is out on that. So they are going to try to move on without him.
They are apparently sticking with their system, which was a necessity, I guess, for their hire. Looking up their coach's name, which escapes me, something Summers. So I'm interested to see what they do. They could easily, if they kind of... John's back.
I'm back.
Yes, I was going through the whole, like, why Georgia Southern has to play triple option or else, like, the school burns down thing.
See, I don't know if I buy it, though, because I feel like Georgia Southern could still do something. I mean, Willie Fritz was a great hire from podcast favorite Tulane, but in general, I feel like there's enough talent in Georgia where they could, at this point, like, recruit. Like, I feel like that was a great differentiator in FCS. I feel like now Georgia Southern has the ability to do whatever it wants in FBS because they've proven themselves.
I think you're probably right, and this sounds like a this is a thing that would happen in Syracuse, like where they just like totally their fan base gets like totally dedicated to this one thing, and they decide that they can never be successful if not for this one thing. But I actually didn't know a lot about it until I was going back over the Bill C previews about how Van Dorter was the head coach there, the now Notre Dame defensive coordinator, and like tried to install a spread and got like run out of town and good. Paul Johnson, like, coming over the top from his perch in Navy and to, like, criticize him and stuff. Very, very interesting. Like, it just, you wouldn't think that a program that was, you know, in FCS for so long would have, like, this strange dedication to an identity. But they do. It's like, that's, like, their 2-3 zone. Like, God forbid the Nets, like, Syracuse coach that is from the outside tries to not run the 2-3 zone. Like, oh, God. I can only imagine what's going to happen in that, if that ever comes to pass.
Yeah, I know Mike Hopkins has already said that he will look at other things besides the 2-3 zone.
But still to be a, like part of the team. Like it's not going to totally go away.
I think people are going to need to like get un it's funny too with especially with the zone again tangent. Cuz it's not as if we use it exclusively. We use it as a trademark of what we did, but it wasn't the only thing. Only recently has become the only thing we've done, and you've even seen divergences from it already under Boeheim with the press. I think that you know Georgia Southern and plenty of other schools would do just fine. The only schools that are beholden to a triple option or an offense like that would be the military academies that need to make up for lack of talent. Just from a you know stars standpoint, it's tough to recruit to those three schools, admittedly. But everybody else, it's all on you. I mean, Georgia Tech in particular. To switch gears to the ACC a little bit, there's nothing preventing a team located in Atlanta from recruiting top 30 every year. And instead, Georgia Tech hangs around the 50-60s range because, you know, no one wants to play in that type of offense, and I can't blame them.
Yeah, I was just thinking about that as you were going there before you brought them up. Like, you'd think being in Atlanta would be such an advantage, especially because that state, like, considering the amount of talent there is in that state, it's not all that picked over. You're starting to see a little more intermingling between the SEC schools or where they're kind of going outside of their states a little bit more, and that gives Georgia a little more attention, but like UGA just dominates that recruiting there so much. You'd think there'd still be enough for Georgia Tech to do whatever it wanted in terms of like the support, the amount of support it gets from its in-state athletes. And they just, they bottle themselves so much by running this triple option. And I appreciate it because I love college football for the different styles that it has. And the triple option is obviously one of them. Granted, only a handful of schools run it. But you think that you would think that Georgia Tech would be a program that wouldn't have to limit itself to it. You think it'd be a more geographically like even like a Syracuse if it wasn't for the dome. Like you think if Syracuse played outdoors, and I don't think I'd want to see this. Like, but that would make sense. Or like a BC or something where you don't have a lot of talent around you and you have mitigating circumstances. Like Georgia Tech just doesn't have those. It's nice most of the year, and you're in a absolute hotbed of talent. And yet you are writing this really specific, athlete-averse system.
Yeah, and that's going to be, as Georgia Southern, I mean, depending on where realignment goes, Georgia Southern is obviously a prime candidate to move up. Should that happen, and should leagues really like kind of implode, I think that's going to be an interesting test for them. It's going to be an interesting test for them, even if they stay in the Sun Belt, is you know, whether or not they can figure out how to be a program beyond that triple option. I think that, again, like it's not mandatory that a school in Georgia does that, and it does seem odd to me that they've stuck with it even with a coaching change.
Right. And obviously, you have the similar comparison to between UGA and Georgia Tech. You have with Georgia Southern and Georgia State.
It's a great segue.
Look at me, killing it.
Yep. Georgia State, located in Atlanta, that's advantageous to them. They lucked in
40 people a game, not so much.
No, but that's fine because they lucked into 6 wins last year.
Yeah, they were easily the most surprising bowl team in the country.
Yeah, I didn't really understand how they got there or why or anything like that, especially when I watched them like lose to FBS newcomer Charlotte, but they did. Yet Georgia State suddenly looks like a program that could be on the move. I think that they're better this year. They get 9 out of 11 starters returning on defense, but at the same time, like, they just have to hit reset on too many positions on offense. I think that even a small downgrade here, just with a mildly tougher schedule, could result in another loss or two, and even one more loss means they're not going bowling. That's fine. I think Georgia State is a program that's well-situated going forward, which is, again, weird to say when I didn't think the same thing 12 months ago.
Yeah, I wouldn't be shocked if we saw some regression in the mean, like you said, because last year, like they looked really bad at points last year, and like 2 years ago, I think was their first in FBS, and I think they opened, they had the first game of the 2014 season, if I remember correctly, and it was against one of those like religious FBS, or I think D2 schools, and it was played in front of, in the Georgia Dome, in front of like 85 people, and they looked awful. I think they won the game. It might have been like Incarnate Word or something. I think. I don't remember. I'd look it up. But it was bad football, and they didn't look all that much better last year, and then they just somehow rolled off 6 wins and got to a bowl game because there were so many teams that weren't eligible. So good for them. I wouldn't be shocked if they fall back to the pack, like you said. They don't have the easiest non-conference. They play Ball State to open, which they could win, but it's kind of a toss-up. At Air Force, probably going to lose. At Wisconsin, they're almost definitely going to lose. Then they have trips to Appalachian State, they have a trip to Troy, which is one of the mid-tier teams in this league. Southern Alabama definitely is a fair toss-up. You still have Arkansas State on the schedule. You have Georgia Southern at home as well. If they get to 6 wins again, that'd be a really big accomplishment.
I would agree. Then to kind of wrap up the rest, I know we're kind of running overtime here. I think those are your top four. I think South Alabama is a potential surprising team. I know a lot of people are high on Troy's upside. And other than that, I really don't buy into any other school in this conference winning more than like 4 games.
It was Abilene Christian, by the way.
Ooh.
And they won 38-37.
Way to go, guys.
And last year they made a bowl. So college football is amazing. Anything can happen.
That's the miracle of the sport. That's why we keep watching, despite Syracuse being pretty god awful for 15 years now.
Yep. And in the Fun Belt, really anything can happen. The Fun Belt, I don't know. Between the Fun Belt and action, it's tough. I don't know. Which do you prefer?
You know, I just think that with the Sun Belt, there's literally nothing off the table in terms of results, and I feel like with Maction, there are certain things that you can just bank on, and like within 2 or 3 games every year, you just kind of have narratives set, especially lately, where I just feel like, you know, Bowling Green, Ohio, Northern Illinois, like Toledo, they're just kind of like these dominant programs over there. I think with the Sun Belt, they're starting to develop some dominant programs, but if you watch like week to week, there is no defense whatsoever. In some of these games, I mean, Troy isn't playing any defense. Texas State's playing defense. Like, even Idaho's figured out how to play offense, even if they don't know how to play defense. Like, you pay attention to some Sun Belt games, and there's a lot of, you know, 55-45 shootouts that literally no one cares about except for the alums of those respective universities. And I feel like with the MAC, like, the MAC gets more television exposure, but a lot of those games are pretty ugly.
Yeah, I think the big advantage of the Mac is even if the product isn't necessarily better, because you have plenty of just clunker Mac games. But the Mac, because those teams are all, like, you know exactly who's in that league, aside from, like, the occasional, like, Temple was there for a minute and UMass there for a minute. Like 10 or so of the teams are consistently, they're just Mac teams. They will probably forever be Mac teams. The league just seems to know what it is and is good at, like, keeping that structure. The Sun Belt, like, from year to year, I have no idea who's in that league. I have looked it up. You know, around now, between now and August, and I'm like, oh, Idaho and New Mexico are still there, and I know they're being kicked out now, so, like, just so much movement, and I think they're kind of pragmatic about getting just the best programs and trying to get, like, some of those fun names and making it happen. The Mac, I think, has just branded itself better. They've kind of adopted the Mac thing, which is great, even if it, you know, when it doesn't always ring true. But you just, you're kind of, like, aware of what those programs are, and Sun Belt is just so all over the place. It's like plug and play with just like it feels like different teams every year.
Yeah, that's a great way to summarize those. Nonetheless, Sun Belt is going to be a fun league. Like I said, I think that there's, you know, four, maybe five teams that you can really look at in the top half, and then the rest are going to be pretty deplorable. I've got Arkansas State, just like Dan does, and then everything else is kind of up for grabs. I think anyone from Georgia Southern on down to Georgia State could finish second. I know in my initial predictions here, I've got like a 2 or 3 way tie up at the top of the league at around 7-1. But I got Arkansas State winning out just based on head-to-head tiebreaker. Again, this is definitely a weird league, a fun league, and one that's going to change even more as its membership continues to shift. I know Coastal Carolina is coming in next year.
Oh, yeah, forgot about that. That should be fun.
Chanticleers!
Good times in the Sun Belt. You never know. You just never know. It's the opposite of Cheers. Like, it's a bar, and you go there, and you have never...
No one knows your name. Oh, hello. My name is Jeff.
The menu is different. They have different drinks. Like, the name's the same, but you're just not sure.
That's it.
So it's a different experience every time.
That's a perfect way to summarize the Sun Belt. That's a good way to wrap it up. Dan, as always, appreciate you hopping on.
Yes, anytime. Next week, who are we doing next week? Conference USA or
Mac? Conference USA.
Yes. Another league, which is actually probably not as fun as the Sun Belt, but similar.
No. No, Conference USA has like a select few really fun teams, and then after that, no.
Yes, but they also, like the Sun Belt, are very, let's say, they're not too wrapped up in making you know who's in that league.
No.
I actually feel like those two just trade teams all the time.
Yeah, they do, and forewarning, I'm definitely going to pine for Old Dominion just for the hell of it.
That's fair. I haven't even looked at it yet, so we will find out next week.
Perfect. On that note, that was Dan. I'm John. Thank you, everyone, for listening to Troy Noon's An Absolute Podcast. Hope you enjoyed at least part of this podcast. And in the meantime, go Orange Women's Lacrosse.
Yes. Go Orange.